Welcome to Intersection Live, the tax and accounting profession's premier podcast source, provided by the CPA Technology Advisor at the intersection of technology and public accounting. The Intersection Live podcast series is brought to you by ADP Small Business Services, supporting the accountant community. This is Tech to Go, a monthly, fast-paced roundtable discussion with executive editor Greg LaFollette and regular columnists Brent Goodfellow, Dave McClure, and Randy Johnston. These thought leaders tackle current technology issues impacting the tax and accounting profession.
This is Tech to Go, episode 20, CPA to Biz. Hello, Greg LaFollette for Intersection Live, Tech to Go, episode 20. I've got my friend Randy Johnston from K2 with us this morning. And Randy, I know you're happy to be home in Kansas.
I'm ecstatic to be home in Kansas. It's been a busy time since April 9th for me. Yep. So a couple of days home are appreciated.
Well, I'm glad that you're willing to once again carve out a little time for us at Tech to Go. We've got Dave McClure joining us, another one of our long-term regulars. Good morning, David.
Well, good morning, Greg.
How's everything in McClure land these days?
It's very busy. I just got back from Salt Lake City yesterday, where I was speaking at a conference, and I leave on Sunday for North Carolina to do the same, and then as you and I discussed, I'm in South Africa next month. So it's
right.
Busy.
And you've got an internet conference in South Africa. We'll be interested to hear about that. In fact, we're going to talk a little bit about that in just a little bit. But before we get there, I want to introduce a returning guest, Darren Root from Practitioner in Indianapolis is joining us. And actually, Darren, you're in Boston speaking at a conference and carved enough time out to come and join us. Good morning and welcome back to Tech to Go.
Good morning. Nothing against Indianapolis, but I actually reside in Bloomington.
That's correct. I'm sorry. I should know better.
You know that.
Yes, I should. Bloomington, home of the great Big Ten school down there, UI, great basketball school. But it's great to have you. And Darren, you're a past president of the Indiana Society and a CITP and serving on the CITP Credential Committee. Lots of experience. I've seen you speak at many things. You're actually doing a webinar for us at the CPA Technology Advisor. That's just coming up here in a couple of weeks in early September, right?
That's right. I need to get ready for it too.
Yeah, the September 10th. You're doing a payroll. You're going to talk about you're doing a webinar on payroll, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, that's exciting. I'm looking forward to that. Guys, before we dive in, we've got a busy agenda and a lot of things here to talk about. But before we dive in, I want to share with you, because you've Dave and Randy, you've been with me since Tech to Go episode 1, as we launched the whole Intersection Live podcast series. And just last month we passed a great milestone, and I want to report to you that we have now had over 100,000 downloads of our Intersection Live podcast series. And I'm pretty happy with that. I think that that says something. Now, that may be 10,000 people each 10 times, or maybe it's my mother 940,000 times or whatever it is. But 100,000, pretty impressive, don't you think?
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, actually. And I'm glad, actually, we get to chat with people on a regular basis like that. And I've had a number of our listeners walk up around the country and say, you know, I heard you talk about this, and it really helped me. And I hope every time that we produce a session that you get a direct benefit.
Well, it's great fun, and I appreciate you guys taking the time. It's, you know, we're certainly kind of out there on the forefront. You know, I truly believe that our listeners are way out ahead of the curve. These aren't your average everyday bears that that are listening to Tech to Go. As I see the people who are listening, they're thought leaders. At least I think. Are those the kind of people that you guys see?
They certainly seem to be. When they're talking to me, they're trying to do innovative things to help their clients and to help their own firms. They're really trying a lot of very interesting things.
So, and Dave, if I'd have asked you for a number, what number would you have thought?
You know, I would have guessed much lower than 100,000, actually, and I probably shouldn't have. But when you think about it, you know, we're really still neophytes. We're still in our first year of doing this, literally. And so to have 100,000 by this point, and especially 100,000 people who know the technology so well, I think is really amazing. I'm delighted that we can perhaps add to their knowledge a little bit, and I certainly they've added to mine.
Right. Well, and again, we will report to all of those 100,000 users or listeners, and we don't know that it's 100,000 because some of them, in fact, many of them, subscribe through iTunes, and it's fun whenever we put up a new episode. As soon as it goes up, there are 800, 900, 1,000, 1,200. You just watch that little counter go as it gets downloaded to all of those people's machines that happen to be turned on and have iTunes open. Those people are regular listeners. And if you want to come and join us, we record live on, as we are this morning, we record live on TalkShoe, and we will be recording on Thursday, September 18th. At 4:30 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time, 4:30 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time, we will be recording episode 21. And Dave, you just made a comment that said this is our first year. We're approaching the end of our second year, pal. This is
getting old, Greg, because time is flying much too quickly. You're right. I don't know what I was thinking.
Yeah, this is episode 20. So, and we've been doing it every month for 20 months. So it's a lot of fun. Well, we've got a bunch of things to talk about. We have a guest that we'll bring in and introduce a little bit later. But I want to start, Dave. We've kind of danced around. You do an awful lot of work over on the internet world, and you're a real you're very involved and do a lot of stuff there. Last week or 10 days ago, the FCC kind of slapped Comcast around a little bit, for some of their packet shaping and stuff like that, and some of that gets a little technical. And this whole idea of internet neutrality, now we got Obama and McCain talking about this. Frankly, I don't think either one of them know what they're talking about. I'm not sure I know what we're talking about. How does this relate, Dave, to accountants and to our clients? Is this kind of, give us an overview, and is this something that we should be concerned about? How does it all fit in?
I think it's something that accountants and their clients should be concerned about, because ultimately it's going to touch on major issues such as document management and client relations, collaborative computing. I know if you look at data storage, for example, and offsite backup, it becomes critical then. So I think there's a very strong link for accountants. It is something we should watch. And it's a very difficult issue. It's very confused. I think even the key players have difficulty defining exactly what network neutrality should mean. But at the heart, I think we're trying to prevent some of the mistakes we've made in other forms of telecommunications. We don't want to allow any company to dictate what device you can use to access the internet or what content you can receive over the internet. And that's really at the heart of it. After that, it breaks down into some very strange discussions. But I think Randy in particular could probably address some of the bandwidth needs that he's seeing with accounting firms that this is going to impact on.
Yep. As a matter of fact, the bandwidth requirements, in my opinion, continue to go up. And when you look at Things like voice over IP, the quality of service needs to go up. If you look at us depending on that for voice, and you look at the practices being dependent upon internet access, being able to have the reliability, and I'm actually going to go so far as to say the redundancy requirements, and we really can't have a lot of what I will call the throttling problems going on, where companies are intentionally controlling certain types of traffic so they can sell other services and so forth. So this whole neutrality thing, I can make 10 or 15 business cases as to why we want some of these things. By the same token, I think most of us are business people enough. We know we have to pay for the services that we're after. So to me, it's a lot more about not being held hostage on some of these fronts.
And beyond that, then, Greg, we get into the whole issue of whether or not this should become law or whether it's policy. Right now it's just policy. It's not a law. And so the Comcast decision came down in sort of a strange manner. Yes, Comcast was holding back people from uploading some kinds of peer-to-peer traffic because they said it was jamming up their network. When the FCC went to investigate, they found, in fact, that this traffic wasn't really jamming up Comcast's network, which called into question what their motivations were. We really don't have a smoking gun for network neutrality. The Comcast case comes as close as we've got to it. And mostly what it's left in its wake is a lot of confusion because there were no fines. There were no particular actions Comcast is required to take. So still a lot of confusion in the internet space.
So to make sure that all of our listeners understand what's really there, Comcast was throttling back BitTorrent, which everyone, quote everyone, looks at as a bunch of teenagers, downloading Star Wars movies. But there are a lot of businesses that use torrent-style processes to move files around the internet, and what might be important to one person looks unimportant to another person. Is that what you're saying, Dave?
Yeah, basically, the problem is that we don't have an easy way. Unless your internet service provider goes in and looks at every message and every packet you send, and I don't think anyone wants that, they don't have an easy way to determine what's good BitTorrent traffic from bad BitTorrent traffic. And that's part of the crux of the problem. But the heart of it really is, who's going to control the network? Who's going to pay for the content flowing over the network? And those are issues that have come down on some very, very harsh political lines, and we don't have an answer yet.
Okay. So, well, Darren, I know you do an awful lot of work remotely. You work with a lot of clients, and you move a lot of files around. You do a lot of VPNing and things like that. Do you see a danger in somebody like Comcast deciding what's an important packet and what's not an important packet?
Well, yeah. Obviously, I must be going along, kind of dumb and stupid because I didn't really realize the issue was a big deal. And yet, we're ramping up all of our internet connectivity. I mean, the things we're putting out in portals, the way we connect to clients, the way, we have remote desktops and things. And that could have, a definite negative impact on our firm and probably lots of firms around the country if that starts changing the way that's done and gets, if companies can start regulating that themselves instead of having some sort of a more of a broad policy or law that we can kind of depend on.
So, Dave, you're right in the thick of this all the time with your organization. What's the response for us as practicing accountants? Should we be saying should we be talking to our legislators and saying figure out the right answer, or should we be saying stay the heck out of this? Or doesn't sound like we can count on free enterprise to solve it. Vigilance is important, but it's only important if you have an idea on what should be happening.
And Greg, you've just hit on the crux of the matter. The real battle is, do we need to regulate this harshly and heavy-handedly right now? or do we need to allow the marketplace time to sort all this out? And nobody has the real answer. I would counsel that people just take a wait-and-see attitude. We have a process in place because we do have what are called the four freedoms, a policy that was adopted by the FCC in 2005, and that's the policy they used to go after Comcast and to rule against Comcast. So I think we've seen in the outset that the FCC has the will and the right to move on this to protect our interests. I think we should just sit back and watch and see how it develops with an eye toward, at some point, if there's really egregious behavior, an understanding that, yeah, we may have to get more active on this as accountants and accounting firms on behalf of our clients as well as ourselves.
Well, as I think about the kinds of, I just reported that we've had 100,000 listeners to the Intersection Live podcast. We will have well over 10,000 viewers, 10,000 attendees at our webcast. And Randy, you've done webcasts with us, and Darren, we were just talking about one. We do these things. We're going to have probably 15 or 18,000 hours of free CPE that we've provided at the CPA Technology Advisor for practitioners all over the country using the web and delivering that. If somebody comes along and starts throttling that, making it difficult to reach, we're in trouble. We're gonna bring on Eric Askerson from CPA to Biz, and I'll bet when we get him on, he's gonna have some comments on some things that CPA to Biz has that they're doing too.
Yeah, and if you look at it in terms of just the CPE delivery, that's one thing, but just begin thinking about software as a service and all the things that were dependent on the web, and if there is a somewhat random or perhaps somewhat calculated decision about what can flow and what can't flow, that could shut you down in a heartbeat. And I was just thinking about you, Darren, as you were talking about your VPNs. One of the problems with standard VPN traffic was firewalls cutting it off versus SSL VPNs, but it's the same type of approach. Somebody can just say, I don't like this port, I don't like this style of traffic, therefore it's not going to happen. I understand the threat because, with the filing against the Russian mafia group from a security and identity theft over the last few weeks, my DoubleCheck spam team has been watching those guys for three and a half years trying to filter and keep that stuff out of people's mailboxes and so forth. I understand there's some bad guys out there that we do want to throttle.
And the question then becomes, what's good and what's bad. I think at the end of the day, what we want to prevent is we want to prevent the kind of situation that we have with, say, my other favorite industry, the cell phone industry, where not only do you only get to choose the devices that they've approved and want to sell you at whatever price they want to sell them to you at, you also don't get all the content you want. And the content you do get, you very often have to pay for at higher than market prices. And I think people are looking at that saying, whatever happens with the Internet, we don't want that model. We want free end-to-end delivery of whatever content we choose to look at. And that's sort of the crux of the battle. Though I have to say, nobody has really threatened to throttle anything that's not illegal. Comcast made the point that the BitTorrent traffic it was throttling was primarily illegal downloads. So it's going to be an interesting battle going forward, and this one is not going to get resolved for a long time.
But on that one, there has been some throttling of, for example, voice over IP, and that is to try to sell the voice over IP service provided by the carrier. So there's an example of where we've seen a little bit of it, because, again, what they're doing is they're cutting off the ports that are going to enable the voice over IP. So they've made the decision, look, we've got a product, therefore you can't use somebody else's voice over IP on our system.
And we sell movies over on our video side, and we're concerned about the delivery of movies via BitTorrent.
Yeah, and not to mention, and I don't want to go too far down this path, but just like the action filed today in the courts out of India for pornography against Microsoft and Yahoo and Google. Okay, I understand why certain geographies may want to control certain types of things, just like we saw going on inside China and other countries. We feel lucky, I think, at times because we're pretty open on those things. But again, it's the decision of what's good and what's bad, and I'm not sure I could call that shot.
Well, I'm not sure that that I can call it, but I'd rather have you call it, Randy, than some of these other guys.
And I'd rather have the opportunity to call it, and I think that's what all this is about. Is
right.
You know, is it a freedom thing? Is it open? That's really to me a lot of it.
Right. So, Dave, you're going to South Africa in a couple of weeks or 3 weeks, I guess, to an international internet conference, and this one is on a whole nother big problem. Give us a quick preview of that before we move on to our next topic.
Oh, gosh, this one's really nasty. It turns out there are secret negotiations going on among the G8 nations to create a new copyright treaty. This is being led by the United States, and it's just packed full of goodies for the content industry, for the music and movie industries, all the things they've never been able to get into law in this country, like requiring ISPs to turn over the names of people who violate copyrights without a warrant, which, you know, now we're protected by the Fourth Amendment. They're trying to get into an international treaty called ACTA.
Okay.
We're there to talk about why this is a really bad idea and what we need to do as consumers to stop it.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to an update on that, and then keep us posted on this this internet neutrality thing, and mostly so that we can start to advise our listeners, and we can all learn and figure out whether or not what kind of action we should be taking. I want to introduce another topic. I've watched our guest today, Darren Root, lecture on a process that he calls the firm of the future, and it actually Darren's got a nice little piece put together that describes his firm in Bloomington, Indiana. This idea of the firm of the future, and it's a conceptual thing, and I've watched Darren write about it and speak about it. And Darren, I'd like you to kind of give our listeners and the rest of our roundtable here kind of an overview of what this is and what your vision is and why it seems to be so interesting to so many firms around the country.
Good. Well, it really has three premises. One is that firms really think about defining what it is that they do. You know, there's a talk in the Indiana CPA Society quite a bit about specialization and how do we educate our membership on this concept that we need to be a little bit more specialized. And so I'm trying to encourage firms, especially small firms, to define what it is that they really do. Try not to be all things to all people. And I kind of took that from the book Good to Great. It was really helpful for our firm in really being more laser-focused in defining what it is that we do as a firm and being
okay.
really good at that. And then the next step is to figure out how to communicate that. You know, historically, it seems like accountants and CPAs have been not good at communicating their services. We're technicians by nature. We're not the best of communicators, and especially from a aesthetic point of view, we don't put our best foot forward. And so I really try to help people understand how to think about putting their best foot forward in their images and their websites and everything that they do, everything that they deliver to the client, the best way to do that. And then the last component is how to deliver that using technology, you know, software, using the internet, using their websites, using portals, paperless office, trying to roll all this into sort of a plan that they can use to deliver these services. We talk a lot about hosted software and the ability to have real-time access to QuickBooks in portals versus, you know, changing files via email or uploads or jump drives or whatever it might be. So it's really those three things, define, communicate, and deliver, and do it in such a way that you have processes and those processes are written and followed up on and everybody and communicated throughout your organizations and that your clients understand those. Does that help?
I think that certainly makes sense to me. Randy, makes sense to you?
Yeah, I think it does because, you know, again, that focus is really part of the deal. And I think repetitively through the years, people have heard us talk about leveraging technology to accomplish the business goals. One thing that a lot of firms, unfortunately, are still faced with is thinking about IT and technology as overhead as opposed to client service and better deliverables. Excuse me. So I think from that vantage point, you know, Darren, it sounds like you're really trying to act upon that, whether it's using paperless technology or whether it's using portals and, you know, with a specific focus in a single industry.
We're just trying to make sure these small firms are putting their best foot forward and using all the technologies that are available to them. And, you know, to be honest, most of the small firms don't realize the technologies and the tools that are available out there, let alone have the ability to implement those. And so we're just trying to show them it's not that hard anymore. I mean, the technology's evolved enough now, it's not that hard. So we're just trying to create an awareness and then also kind of show them how to use those technologies.
Yeah, and it's interesting when I go out for CPA firm tech assessments, a lot of firms actually don't know this, but I am literally trying to get a physical impression. And for our listeners, it probably is good the next time that you walk into your office, just think about how someone who's never been to your office before would look at your office, whether that's paper clutter, whether that's disrepair, or whether it's, you know, elegance and, you know, for kind of a first-class approach. And when you're using technology that frankly needs repair, or, you know, we'll just call it the old you know, clunker driving down the road, when you see one of those, you really get a certain impression. And I think a lot of firms are leading with what I would call very clunky technology, and I know what my impression is, but I also know I've got a bias towards the technology impression.
You know, I think that most of us seem to buy off the way things make us feel. They recently opened a Starbucks across the street from my office, and I use this as an example. You know, as we watched them build that and get it ready, you know, I had an expectation. I knew what that Starbucks was going to be like, and when I went in there for the first time, it met all my expectations. I mean, visually it was nice. It gave me the feeling I was looking for. It was everything I expected it to be. And I'm trying to get practitioners to think about how they make their clients feel, whether it's when they're visiting their website or when they're walking in their front door or their interactions with their staff. It's really a lot about the way things make you feel. It brings you back to those places.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing that I'm really concerned about on the technology, so much of the time there is attitudes about I want certain looks and so forth. And although historically that's been important, and although I'm not wanting people to be sloppy, I think there's still a lot of actions around things that don't add value, and we'll just call it the prettiness of reports and the fonts all being the same, versus the content at times. And again, I still want them to be professional looking, but I see a whole lot of effort being spent on clerical prettiness where a little bit more accounting advisement and thought would be so much more valuable to the clients.
Yep, I agree.
You know, I absolutely agree, but I would throw in another part here. You know, Bill Lockhart has built a great business based on the understanding that the average client, when you're handing the average client a financial statement or a tax return, they don't have a way of measuring your technical competency. Their assumption is that it is accurate and correct and appropriately prepared. Their only way that they have to measure is whether or not it looks good. So if you have, and I'm painting with a very wide brush, I understand that, but if you have a report that looks good, it's professionally put together, it's got a nice linen cover with embossing or whatever it happens to be, you know, as compared with something that is adequate, many clients are going to look at that and assume that the higher class one is somehow a better product than the other one. Is that a fair assessment, Darren, do you think?
It's fair for me because that's the way I do my buying. I mean, the more aesthetically, I mean, I don't know whether I go to a good or bad doctor. I can't discern that. I'm still ticking, so I'm assuming he's okay. But that's all I have to assess with, as to whether he's a good doctor. I don't know much different about my attorney, and I'm a reasonably educated consumer. And so I can only assume that most of our clients don't know. They assume the accuracy. You know, one of the things that I really preach to the people I'm talking to is just this idea of consistency as well. I mean, quality is assumed, which is why I want you to define what it is that you do.
Sure.
The more you define, and I suggest that people only do things that they're really great at. They get rid of the stuff that they're bad at. They don't do much of the stuff they're good at. Do the things that you're really great at, which I think enhances your quality. I mean, if somebody asks me to do a 990, I usually say, no thanks, I don't have any idea how to do those. But maybe an S-Corp return I'm really good at. So we focus on doing the things that we're really good at. And then we also try to get these practitioners to, just because they put out a nice-looking report, their website may look terrible. So we try to get consistency so that the user of these services gets an impression that the practitioner really knows what they're doing. Because no matter how smart you are, if you deliver it very poorly, the consumer, I think, gets a bad impression.
And some of these can be very, very simple to do. Historically, one that we recommended 10 or 12 years ago was actually printing certain portions of the reports in color.
Right.
You know, color lasers were, you know, somewhat more expensive, but today they're so cheap. And, you know, including a firm's logo in their report and so forth, those are pretty trivial tasks to take. And it is common in my own reports, for example, I always include pictures that I take while I was there. So, again, using the technologies has very, very little extra cost, but the impression can be quite noticeable.
I agree.
For many years, I consulted with accounting firms on exactly this, and what we tried to tell them is that your visual appeal is a proxy for your professionalism. That you're right, they can't judge, and even when you hand them a sheet of paper with columns of figures on it, very often these are forms where you don't have the flexibility to color them up or to make them look more interesting, more professional. So your client has to judge based on other things, and that's why it's critical that maybe you buy a monitor for your reception area that runs continuously a presentation about the firm or gives them an idea of who you are. That you put your technology foot forward because it's a proxy. It says we keep pace with the times and we understand your business because we understand the technology is important to you as well.
You know, an example of using that larger screen technology for firms that are doing wealth management practices, you know, think about the times that you have clients in the office and their ability to look at a large screen and what that says in terms of just being able to present information and the impression that it makes. You know, I've been in some firms doing wealth management where, you know, I wonder if they can really manage the money because of the way the firm looks. And by the same token, I've been in others where, you know, it's clear that they've just got an air of professionalism and the way that they're handling it, and they're making some of those impressions by using technologies in smart ways.
Hey guys, I'm gonna give you a demonstration right here of what I would call a flying segue. I wanna bring our guest in and our next topic, but. You know, we're going to talk about CPA to Biz, and if you've gone and looked at the CPA to Biz website in terms of overall professionalism and what I'm going to say a world class delivery system in terms of the shopping cart, but you know the way that thing has developed has. I mean, these guys understand that you gotta look good to be perceived to be good. Have any of you guys taken a look at that website lately?
Yes, matter of fact, I have been on it several times over the last couple of weeks for one reason or another. And you know, the other thing is, if you think about time frames, this didn't happen overnight. This has been a multi-year building proposition. And for our listeners, I would want them to not get frustrated, because this will take some effort, but small steps will allow you to eventually get there. But you've got to get your vision of where you're going to be able to make those steps.
Exactly. I want to introduce the panelists and all of our listeners to Eric Askerson. And Eric is the CEO of CPA to Biz, and has been around CPA to Biz for 5 or 6, maybe 7 years now, Eric. Would that be about right?
That's correct, Greg.
Okay. This is an organization that that was frankly birthed hard. And floundered maybe a bit and I think the profession maybe floundered in understanding what was there. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I, Greg, I think it is. I think just going back to a comment Darren made about focus and the book he liked, Good to Great by Jim Collins. If you look at right out of the gate, what occurred with CPA to Biz, and there was a lot of other things going on at that time. Clearly, right out of the gate, the company tried to do too much. And what we've done over the past 5 years, really, and I've been the CEO since 2002, is really been very, very focused. And we've stuck to our original charter, which is very clear, and I'll talk a little bit about that.
Uh-huh.
But it's that acute focus and putting the right talent in place. We've got a group of marketing, technology, and alliance folks that are very good at what they do. They've got backgrounds that are very relevant. And actually, it's a great complement to the AICPA. And when you look at why companies form subsidiaries, there's lots of companies that do it. There's not-for-profits and there's for-profits that do it. And the reason why is because they need an organization to have a very acute focus with some unique talent and capabilities to deliver upon the charter that they provide them. So that's why we've been successful the past 5 years, very related to a lot of the stuff Darren was just talking about. And you're right, right out of the, there was a lot of stuff going on back in 01 and 02, not just related to CPA to Biz, but right out of the gate, things did not go as planned. But the good news is, we're just finishing up once again one of our best years, and I'm very, very excited about the programs and services that we're offering.
So, Eric,
the membership.
Let's go back and review the kind of the bidding here for the listeners, because you live in CPA to Biz every day, so you know exactly what it is. I would argue that the average accountant on the street still the average CPA, AICPA member still doesn't have a real clear vision. What is that charter? I mean, you do all things saleable by the Institute are for sale by CPA to Biz. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
I mean, and just so real quickly, CPA to Biz is the marketing technology subsidiary of the AICPA, formed in 2000 by the AICPA Board of Management. And the two-part charter is very straightforward. The first part of it is to provide best-in-class marketing and technology services to the AICPA and some other parties. And with that first part of the charter, we do all of the marketing, most of, maybe 90% of the marketing for the AICPA around their products and services, their conference line, their publication line, their CPE lines. And we run the e-commerce site. One of the key parts of that first part of the charter was to build a leading e-commerce site for the CPA channel. They wanted to do this within the CPA community. At that time, WebMD was created outside of the AMA, the American Medical Association. The board here wanted to have an entity that was closely tied to the profession. So the first part of that charter is for us to provide marketing services to the AICPA and to run the e-commerce site that sells AICPA products, among other products.
You have a deep and rich I guess what I will call an affinity program. You've got a group of people, Eric, that go out and vet products and services that you feel, and I'm saying you, but that's kind of probably the royal you, that you feel are appropriate for the membership, and you run through that process. And tell me how does that work, and kind of what's the philosophy? What are the highlights?
Okay, so when you come to the CPA to Biz site, you have all of the, I'd say, profession related products and services, the conferences, the publications, our webcasts, our online products. What you're just referencing are the affinity programs, and that is an activity that we do support. It's a member benefit for AICPA members. And how we run that part of the business, and just to talk a little bit about affinity, I mean, the AICPA ranks atop the peer associations, the number of affinity programs offered. There's about 15. The leading affinity program that everyone knows a lot about is the Aon insurance program. But the there's the other programs, there's Dell, and there's Hertz, and there's Starwood, and Xerox. How we go about establishing these programs is we do surveys to our members. At times, there's RFPs done. And other times, companies do approach us, and they've got a very specific focus on the CPA channel, and they've got a high-quality product, and we form relationships with them. But the underlying principle for all of these programs is member value. The affinity programs actually are not a large revenue contribution source to CPA to Biz or the AICPA. This is more of a member value component, and that's the most important thing about these programs. And we benchmark our programs against some of the other leading associations, the AAA, AARP, and Costco, because what we're trying to do here, and it's particularly geared towards the small firm, is that a small firm that, like a big company, if they need to rent cars, they need hotel stays, we want to do a big group buy for them and negotiate a value pack. So that's the affinity programs that you see under the member benefits section of the CPA to Biz site.
Okay. So let me toss a question over to Darren. Darren, I know you talk to hundreds and hundreds of accountants around the country. Is it your feeling, do they report to you that they see these affinity programs as very valuable, kind of valuable, not valuable at all? What do you hear?
No, I wish I could say that we actually talk about it, because I could report better. I just don't hear them talking about it. I would suspect that there's not so much of an awareness.
Okay.
Within the small practitioners would be my guess, and I don't know that for sure, but that's probably my guess.
I tend to agree, and Eric and I have had this conversation. I tend to agree. Dave, you see a lot of people. You think for example, the Dell deal or the Hertz deal is particularly valuable to practicing accountants?
More so than you'd think, because
okay.
I've worked with affinity programs with a lot of nonprofits, and I'm constantly astounded because I hate the things. I personally look at them and think I'd never use them in a million years, and I could get a better deal myself. Personally shopping around, and that may well be true, but the minute you try to cut them, you're going to find there's a very loyal group of people who know them and use them religiously and believe that they're very high value, and I was shocked to find that.
And Greg, the thing is, over the past few years, this whole space has become more challenging, and it's something that I think, we're supporting this for the AICPA, that associations do grapple with. Does it make sense to continue to have these affinity programs due to the commoditization of some of these products and due to, Costco's and the Internet offering other pricing advantages? And that's something that we think long and hard about. But at the end of the day, we go and we push. The number one push we provide, if it's to a Hertz or to a Dell or to a Starwood, is in the value prop and saying we want the best possible discount. If we're going to do a program with you for our members, you've got to make it as good as the AAA and the AARP programs, if not better. And that's where we're pushing. But things have changed, and there are the there are organizations that are just saying it doesn't make sense. The good news is the group buying power is still there, that we think there is still a value component. So that this is something I say it's a value add. As I said earlier, this is not something that is a revenue focus from a CPA to biz standpoint. And even from you look at our site, we don't have advertising. This is not something that a partner cannot come to us and buy this endorsement. The way you become an affinity partner is that you're going to offer a pricing discount to the membership that hopefully they cannot get elsewhere. But in today's world, as Dave just said, if you really search long and hard, you probably can come very close to the leading association partnerships. But some people do use it, and there's some efficiency for not having to search for all of these discounts online and just go through your association to get the best value.
Sure. Now, Randy, I know that there are hundreds of accountants around the country that wouldn't even dream of buying any hardware without the Randy Johnson blessing. Do you see this the Dell deal used a lot? Do you see people picking up on that and utilizing it?
I do, and in fact, what will actually happen in the process is they will either purchase straight away through the affinity program, or they use the affinity program to actually negotiate even a better deal. Now, that's a little bit frustrating at times because, with the affinity programs, as you just heard Eric say, they're really looking for the best deal. You will not make a better deal is what they're really trying to accomplish there. But it is clear that many of the buyers are using the affinity deals, and Dell has made those deals to try to drive volume. So, it's in Dell's best interest, and it's in the buyer's best interest to actually use those. And I think that the earlier comment, and several of you reiterated this, you don't hear people talk about it a lot. You don't, but I do see them used a lot. And I'm going to pick on the Hertz deal as a good example. It's just, that is just kind of a natural. You just walk up, it's done, and so forth. So I think many of these are used, but not discussed a lot.
Okay, so Eric, we're kind of getting towards the end of our time, but kind of run through for us. We talked about the Dell and the Hertz and the Starwood. There are some other things, and right now you've just done this deal with Bill.com, and you've got a payroll provider, some other things. Tell me about those, because those are a little bit different than the kind of the run of the mill things, aren't they?
Yeah, that's correct. We just were talking with these affinity programs where it's mainly a group buy, and there's limited marketing, but there is there's awareness marketing done by us to the membership. But the programs you just mentioned, the Bill.com relationship, that's about the second part of our charter. And the second part of our charter is to help CPA firms build better, strong relationships with their small business clients through unique programs and services. And a lot of that's around e-enablement. And when we were formed, we do have a technology team in the Silicon Valley area. They're actually in Santa Clara. That's where our technology office is. And we were doing some primary application development. What we're doing now is, and this is the Bill.com is a great example of it, is we're working closely with what we think are leading providers that can help the firm build a better relationship with their client. And what we're excited about right now is what's happening in the SaaS space and how firms can dramatically improve the way they interact with their clients through a web-based application like Bill.com. And with Bill.com, what we're doing is we're involved on both the development side. We're providing input and collaborating on developing the accountants module. And we also are doing the marketing distribution. So we do have tremendous marketing capabilities, but with these programs, which we call business solutions, there's much greater product level involvement. And with Bill.com, the reception has been very, very positive, and you're going to see a lot more of those types of web-based service programs from CPA to Biz that are right in line with the second part of our charter. We've got a couple of other ones that are going to be coming out this fall.
Eric, that's a very exciting part of our business development. Yeah, Eric, it's just the four or five of us here. You can go ahead and tell us about a couple of those if you'd like.
There's one that I don't want to kind of mention publicly yet. I'll mention one that we have finalized, but we haven't put the large announcement in the marketplace. We're piloting it, and it's a relationship with Google, where we're going to be helping firms manage the AdWord purchase process. And we think this is a great opportunity for firms. Local search is becoming a key way to connect with your clients, and this is a capability that we're going to be putting in place for firms to leverage. So that's a program that you guys are one of the first to hear about, you know, from a public standpoint. But that is right now in pilot, and that relationship is finalized, and we'll be going to a full commercial launch this fall.
Super. Randy, you got to be excited about that. You're all about search engine optimization and stuff, right?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I have had a fair bit of encouragement on that, and it actually is a feature built into QuickBooks that many people don't use today, and that's a little frustrating to me.
Yep. Yep. Well, Eric Askerson, I want to thank you a whole lot for joining us on Tech2Go. I have certainly learned a lot about what's going on over at CPA to Biz. Next week, I'm going to be in Chicago for the Illinois show, and I know Darren, you're going to be there. CPA to Biz will be there with their booth with Bill.com in that booth, and I'm doing the walking tours for the Illinois Society again, and Bill.com is one of the technologies that I chose to be on that walking tour, so we'll be stopping by to look at it. I think you guys did a great job in putting that deal together, and I'm pretty impressed with what you're doing. Thanks so very much for coming and joining us.
Well, thank you, Greg, and it was great listening to today's discussion. So thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so let's move on, Randy. I've got another topic here that I'd like you to talk about just a little bit. I read one of your mini articles. You're a prolific guy, and you're talking about this whole idea of green technology in accounting firms. And some people think green means the green on the trees. Sometimes it means the green in your wallet for the money that you save. Which green are you talking about here?
Well, I'm certainly not a tree hugger when it comes to this, but it seems to me that if you are ecologically responsible, it actually winds up making you more money in the process, which is important. But I would just say in the short term, one of the things that I'm concerned about is green legislation that's occurring. For example, Oklahoma has a new piece of legislation for the recycling of electronics that goes into effect January 1. And basically, it requires computer manufacturers to have a state-approved recovery plan. And that includes existing collection and consolidation. It can be set up to be jointly managed. It can be used with processors, with reuse organizations, with not-for-profit, with retailers. But it basically has a requirement. And I think that will not be the last example of that. We also see a number of manufacturers who've been trying to do this properly as we go, and whether that's the Dells or the HPs of the world, just as two examples, but they're making a very proactive effort to recover these old computers. There are going to be millions, if not hundreds of millions, disposed of, and ecologically they're very dangerous, frankly. So they've got to be recycled or used properly. I thought it was quite interesting in the last 2 weeks that at Linux World that there were school systems in California set up on Linux systems, which in many, many cases we can use lower-powered computers and accomplish a lot of the standard computing tasks. So one of the things to think about is, you know, for the manufacturers that you're dealing with, understanding the recycling program. I believe you'll find a lot more state and local requirements on the recycling pieces, and that it's good that as you're trying to replace your equipment that you figure out what the target becomes. Is it going to be reused? Is it going to be disposed? Whatever. But, you know, it's interesting to me that it took us 27 years to reach a billion computers, and we will reach our second billion computers by the year 2014. And when we think about the USA, Western Europe, and Japan right now, they have about 60% of all PCs in use and have only roughly 15% of the population. And if the Gartner estimates are correct that there's 180 million PCs replaced every year, the concern, of course, is what do you do with those 180 million? Now, the one other cut is, of course, virtualization, and there's power savings, and there's air conditioning savings, and at the desktop, there's savings, whether that's hibernating computers, shutting them off entirely, shutting off monitors. I realize the electricity savings are relatively small, but in effect, there's something that just with a little intelligent action, we can all, you know, save a few dollars while saving a lot more of oil use or any other energy use.
So it seems to me there's really a couple of different issues here, and you know, one of them becomes the ownership of a computer. You know, what do you do with it? That's kind of the virtualization. It's the issue of whether you turn them off or turn them on. Used to be pretty much common best practice or common practice to that they stayed on, and now I think that's pretty much flopped to they stay off. But lots of opinion there. And then there's the whole other issue of what do I do with it when I'm done with it? It used to be that firms didn't have to think about that, or the biggest issue was how do I ensure that my data is removed before I get rid of it. Now we've got a problem beyond that. So actually, small firms, all firms, but small firms have to now think about this. That's really what you're saying, right?
I really am. And if we think about something we've historically had, CRT monitors, we think about the digital TV conversions and all these TVs that could wind up getting recycled, disposed. Yes, we really got the acquisition, and then the operation, which I think fits on both the server and the workstation side, and the disposal. And it actually is, I think, a wise thing to think through your strategy because, again, what do you do with the old stuff? And, oh, by the way, don't forget the security of the data because shutting off the computers actually leads to greater security than putting them in hibernate. And that data that's on those drives that you're disposing, how do you make sure that you aren't disposing good, valuable data that is actually used for bad purposes? And there's many studies that prove that happens. And again, we see a whole lot of bad computers that confidential client data is left on. So you need to have some real proactive strategies about how we protect the data when we're going through the disposal process as well.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have enough time to devote to this topic that we really should. But so you know, I think we'll hold this over and discuss it a lot more on both the ownership side and the disposal side. But I want to I'm going to confess to the rest of the group, my computers in my home office where I decide what I'm going to do, my computers stay on all the time. And I've come to that conclusion because they're busy all the time. You know, I run my updates at night. I run my backups, my synchronizations, all of that stuff. And when I'm out, I need to hit my something at home. I come in through my home server. You know, I want my desktop on so that I can access it if I need it. And you know, I know that there are solutions to allow me to turn it on remotely, but I'm not interested in doing that. So I confess, I kill trees or add extra carbon to the earth by leaving my computers on. Darren, what do you do?
I think I'm in the same boat that you are. I like the access.
Yeah.
And the convenience.
Randy, or Dave, what do you do? Yours on or off?
I leave mine on because, frankly, it takes more power to power it back up consistently or continuously during the day than it does if you just leave it on. These things are designed to be left on.
Okay.
You're actually wearing them out rapidly if you turn them on and off.
Okay.
And the other thing I wanted to comment on the disposal side, since I may not be here next time, there are programs to help you dispose of your tech gear to third world countries. We give all our cell phones to a service that takes them to Africa, to undeveloped countries, and computers as well. You got to look for them, but they're there.
Ah, interesting. I'm going to ask you to send me a little bit of information on that, Dave, and I'll include that link in the show notes. I'm not sure that I'm usually so mad at my cell phones by the time I cycle them out, I'm not sure I'd want to give them to anybody.
You and I are alike in that. We both hate our cell phones, Greg, so I can sympathize. I've usually thrown mine against a brick wall so often they're not useful for anyone.
They don't bounce worth a darn. So, Randy, we got 3-0 on leaving machines on. Where are you?
Yep, I'm on the other side of that game now. I was like you guys, leaving the machines on, but I've actually found I don't need to. And really the workarounds or methodologies are now becoming plain enough. So that would be my normal expectation. And Dave, just like in your observation, the old thinking was these machines were designed to be left on. They have been historically, but a lot of the new designs are actually designed to be turned off. During the workday, nah, we're going to leave them on because they are getting the activity. But shutting them down at the end of business day, shutting down the home systems, again, our listeners know that I travel enough, I'm frequently gone. So if you think about my situation where I might be out for a week, this week I left on Sunday, returned on a Wednesday. That's a short week for me. But there's 4 days that the machines were completely off.
Well, it's an interesting conversation, and I think we're going to lead next month with a continuation of this conversation because I find it pretty interesting, and I know many of our listeners do because there's lots of pressures all the way around to figure out what to do, and I think we can spend a fair amount of time dealing with this disposal. First, the data issue, and then finally the ecological issue. So, guys, we are out of time. We're going to record episode 21 at 4:30 Mountain Daylight on Thursday, September 18th. I want to thank my friend Dave McClure for joining us and wish you safe travels to the other side of the world. You're going to be in South Africa. What cities, Dave?
Actually going to be in Johannesburg by way of Amsterdam, so I'm pretty much staying close to the conference hotel. They have a pretty full agenda for us.
Well, I travel safely, learn a lot, and we'll look forward to visiting with you when you're back in October for episode 22 of Tech to Go. Darren Root, thanks again for, I know you hopped out of a conference to come and join us. Thank you so very, very much for, again, sitting in, this time for Brett Goodfellow, who had some cockamamie story about salmon fishing out in on the river in the desert in Oregon.
Well, it's always my pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you next week in Chicago.
Well, we'll see you there, and hopefully you'll be able to join us on September 18th. You'll have two Tech to Go's right in a row.
Okay.
Super. Thanks for joining us. And Reverend Johnson, as always, thank you for your contributions to Tech2Go and Intersection Live and the profession as a whole. And we appreciate you.
Hey, we are happy to help where we can and hope that it benefits each of your practices and just your daily lives as we're trying to talk through all this technology piece.
Everybody hang in there. We will see you again on Thursday, September 18th. Bye for now. This has been Tech2Go, Episode 20, CPA to Biz.
For more information about the CPA Technology Advisor's other podcast programs, webcasts, and our e-newsletter, visit www.cpatechadvisor.com. To ask questions or leave comments about our podcasts, call 800-456-0864, extension 2106. Or tune in to future episodes where you're able to ask questions live via TalkShoe.com.